All right, here we are with another episode of the High Ground, powered by Premier Companies. Good morning, Sal.
Good morning, Ryan.
How's it going today?
Yeah, I'm doing wonderful.
Well, we got Matt Makinson back.
You look
back at our calendar, and it's been 2 years since you've been here. So, Matt Makinson with Country Mark, VP of Supply and Marketing. How's it going this morning?
Excellent. It's been too long.
Yeah, we're glad you're back.
I can't believe it's been that long.
I know.
You've probably got some stuff to talk about over the last 2 years. We're going to kick you off with the question of the day, like we do everyone. And this morning, we want to know, Matt, are you more scared of heights or snakes?
I would say situational. Heights.
And if it's neither.
You're right. You're going to need to leave.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't love both. I say heights, if I could hold on to something, I'm all right with. It's the stuff where you're standing on a ledge where there's nothing to hold on to. We were zip lining in Tennessee with my family, and my kids up on a zip line didn't love that. But snakes, I don't mind snakes except in water. You get snakes combined with water, like a brackish pond.
Yeah.
No, not going in there.
Your chances seem reduced once you get in the water with one.
Yeah.
Sal?
Yeah. Well, you got no chance. No chance there.
No, you don't see them coming.
Well, we ought to call this the goosebump episode because all the listeners right now are going to think about standing on a ledge and snakes in
with
water.
With a snake underneath them.
Yeah. Well, I really don't like heights, and I don't have enough hands to hold on to enough stuff whenever I'm above 10 feet or up in the air. And, of course, we had the silos and stuff when I was a kid, and Dad would tie tools, like with binder twine to you, so you could – that was how you got the tools up, right? You go up the inside, and it wasn't that bad because we had the, the chute. Get tired, you could lean back against it or something. But I don't like heights, and I don't really care for snakes either, but heights would be the one. Last weekend, I won't kill everyone I see, but I got one with a backhoe last weekend and had the thumb and squeezed him and had him waved him at Dad over at the side. So,
yeesh. I don't even like to see him. But
nope.
But for me, it would be a hard – that's a toss-up for me. But I can overcome heights. I just don't like snakes at all. That's been a long-standing thing. Everybody I worked with knows that snakes I have a real problem with. But heights I can sort of deal with. I don't love it. I'm like you. If I don't have necessarily something to hang on to, I don't like it. But snakes are a problem. But when I was in college, I cut tobacco just to try it. Never done it before. So then we went to the barn and we were hanging them.
So
I'm trying to think, I'm trying to be smart about this. So it's like, hey, we're going to hand these up and you're going to hand these sticks up with all these leaves on. You're going to hang them as you do burley tobacco in these barns. So me being one who's trying to be a thinker, I thought the higher you get in that barn, the less of those you'll have to handle. That's going to be the last guy.
Sure. I'll give you credit for there, yeah.
Well, you get up there, and I'm like, well, I don't really like heights, but I'll go up there. And they go, how do you feel about snakes? And I said, well, I don't really like snakes. Well, a lot of times they'll get up there and rest. I said, I can't imagine a worse scenario than being up high with a snake.
Sure. There's no, you can't escape.
No. So I'm sure there's a lot of people with other phobias out there. But, heights and snakes, that's front of mind for me when I came up with this question. So I'll
never forget Bell and Hay when I was a kid and I was pulling, you got promoted. When you drove the tractor pulling the hay wagon as they were picking up the bales, all the square bales we used to have. And if you was a kid, that was your job. I guess they found one. I'll never forget my cousins bailing off the hay wagon when there was a snake, big old black snake was in a hay bale that come up there and they threw it up on the wagon. Oh, I was like, what?
Vacate the premises pretty quick. I remember my dad, he always said, I was in high school. I remember him making the comment one time. He's like, I've never been scared of a snake that I happen to see. I'm like, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. The only snakes I've ever been scared of are the ones I can see.
That's true.
And I'm not scared of if I can see them. The only ones I'm scared of are the ones I can see. I don't like that at all. So, all right, well, let's get back to something more important than this. So, Matt, it's been 2 years. We've already talked about it. So, what's going on in the world of Country Mark? And you got a big project going on at the refinery.
Yeah, we do. So the, obviously we're a diesel centric company. We have a, premium diesel product and we're doing a large project to make it better, to make more diesel and to improve the qualities of it. So it's a renewable diesel co-processing project. And it's really in two phases, I guess. The first one is expanding the capacity of the refinery, and this project allows us to do that. So we'll be able to make more diesel. That's step number one. And we'll be able to run more crude, which makes us, you know, more competitive and make more products. And then we're also adding a capability to process soybean oil. So it'll be a co-processed renewable diesel with all the benefits of renewable diesel. That will be, you know, an added value to our members.
And so what are some of those benefits of renewable diesel? And we're kind of hearing some of this about renewable aviation fuel and, yeah, and other things. So what's some of the benefits? Obviously sustainability, mm-hmm, but burns cleaner and...
Yeah. There's a lot of interesting properties. So our project is using, soybean oil, as I said, co-processing it, and renewable diesel, different from biodiesel. So I'll classify it as, you know, traditional biodiesel is FAME, fatty acid methyl ester. So it's an esterification process. Renewable diesel, the simplest way to think about it is it's hydrotreated vegetable oil or fat. And that process is different. There's no oxygen with that. You're breaking up the molecules, and basically you're making out of soybean oil the exact same molecular structure as what's in diesel fuel. So it's molecularly the same. Wow. It's a drop-in fuel, so there's no concerns with moving it on a pipeline, keeping it in tanks. It doesn't attract water. It's got high cetane, which is a good property of diesel. It's got good winter operability from low cloud point. It's got no NOx, no sulfur, and no ash. So really good properties. It's a really good cut of the diesel portion that, you know, has a lot of good properties that you're looking for.
And that's the renewable diesel?
Yeah.
What do we blend down here at our pumps in Brownstown, do we know?
That's just biodiesel.
That's biodiesel? Mm-hmm. Okay.
So biodiesel, you know, obviously we do a lot of biodiesel in the country. And, you know, this has been the standard product. Renewable diesel is an evolution of that. And it's changing it from, as I said, an esterification from a traditional biodiesel plant. And there's challenges with biodiesel. You know, it can be a really good quality product. Winter operability has been a challenge in the past. This is just a different way to do it. And so refiners are doing this now. And so it's kind of an evolution of traditional biodiesel producers. Refiners are making renewable diesel. A lot of them have, you know, transformed their plants or shut down refineries and changed them to a renewable diesel plant. A lot of those facilities are only making renewable diesel. And so there's no other fossil fuel, crude oil processing. They just converted the plant.
Wow.
But our project is different. Obviously, we're not closing down the refinery. This is just an expansion of the refinery, an expansion of our ability to make diesel fuel. And we have the option to put in soybean oil and get all the benefits of the renewable diesel component of that.
So where will you get your soybean oil from, and does it have to be something different than what you cook with?
Yeah, so so there's a couple different ways you can do it. So what people have done in the industry is they've taken and they've made a pretreatment, is what we call it. So you take cooking oil or tallow or grease or soybean oil, and you pretreat it. You know, a fairly complicated process to make it usable. Another option is basically food grade soybean oil, and then you don't have to pre-treat it. So it's kind of, you know, people have gone different ways. The industry has a lot of pre-treatment capacity now, and so you could go buy pre-treated feedstocks from somebody, or you could buy like a food grade soybean oil to use that instead. And, you know, several people across the country and in our area produce that today. So it's widely available.
Okay.
Wow. Will that go in the same pipelines and the same pumps and everything else when it gets here?
Yeah. So after it goes through our refinery process units, just like all the diesel that we do, it'll be molecularly the same.
Same.
And you won't be able to tell. Some of what they do to be able to prove how much is in there is actually do like radiocarbon 14 dating, and it will actually help identify what percentage it is, but any other methodology that you're using, you never can tell. It's molecularly the same. So there's no, it's high performance fuel. no downside effects to it at all. It's really interesting technology and kind of the evolution of, you know, renewable blending of transportation fuels.
What crop would that be?
Just soybeans.
Just soybeans.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So
that's neat.
Well, and we know that there's been a cost for several years now for blending, mm-hmm. or the lack thereof blending. So how does this, what advantage does this provide Country Mark now with this opportunity?
Yeah, that's a good question. So if we go back to the basics of renewable fuel standard requires refiners to blend, you know, a certain percentage of renewables. Country Mark's done that through ethanol blending and biodiesel blending, you know, for over a decade. The cost of that has been increasing as the cost of compliance. So if you don't blend enough, which Country Mark can't blend enough to meet its obligation.
But you blend all you can.
Yeah, we blend everything we can. And you know, the percentages mandated by the EPA are just too high for us to meet. So we have to buy additional RIN credits from other people who are blending in order to meet that compliance. And we've spent tens of millions of dollars every year in order to do that. What this project does, it allows us to increase our level of renewable blending. And, you know, the balance of, hey, I have to buy soybean oil, I'm selling it as diesel, and then I generate a RIN by doing that. Renewable diesel has a little bit of an advantage because it's lower greenhouse gas emissions and, you know, good BTUs. So if you blend a gallon of biodiesel, you get 1.5 RINs. If you co-process or do renewable diesel, you get 1.7 RINs. So you actually get a little bit more RIN per gallon, which has some, you know, obviously some economic benefits. So the main goal of this is to increase our diesel output, which is a key goal. It also will improve the quality of our diesel and add some sustainability benefits to the people who purchase it. And then it's really a hedge against RFS compliance cost. So it doesn't necessarily make you a lot of money, but it says, hey, if RIN prices go up, I own the RINs, and so I'm not exposed completely to the market. If RINs go to $2 or $3 or something, you know, very, very high due to EPA, you know, rules or volume obligations, then Country Mark's protected against that. So we don't have just unlimited exposure to the marketplace. So it helps, you know, long-term viability of the company and make sure that we can manage, you know, the future, the unknown future.
And as these diesel motors get, I don't know what the right word is, but more technologically improved, mm-hmm. they require a cleaner, more pure diesel fuel, correct?
No, for sure. Yeah, I mean the way that the industry has moved to meet the emission regulations, is tighter specs on everything, whether it's filters, whether it's injectors. Our PDX4 product has a the best additive that that the money can buy, I would say. And, you know, it's trying to remove deposits from injectors. It's trying to make sure everything about that fuel is as clean and high-performing as it can be to meet the stringent specifications of today's engines.
Wow.
And fuel filters are another big one, obviously. So winter operability, we spend a lot of time and energy and focus on changing how we operate in the wintertime to make sure that the wax particles that are naturally in diesel, we do things in the refinery to take those out, to cut that portion of the diesel away so that we have less wax, less paraffin in the diesel so that you have less likelihood of any kind of winter operability. So then combination of changing the refinery, specialized additives to make the product, make sure there's no suspension of wax in the fuel to combat, tighter tolerances on fuel filters and those things.
That's exciting stuff.
So your changes to the refiner, you say you're going to expand and be able to process more crude, mm-hmm. and produce more diesel fuel. Are the changes that you're making going to allow you to do more diesel out of a barrel of crude or just more barrels of crude?
A little bit of both. So today, we're about 35,000 barrels a day. This expansion will allow us to go up about 1,500 barrels a day. So, a reasonable increase. Part of what, when we talk about winter operability, part of what we do in the wintertime to lower the cloud point of our fuel is we take this waxy part of the diesel and we cut it out, and it goes to other products, gasoline and other process units. So we actually make less diesel in the winter than we do in the summer. And so the challenge of that, so this project through some different technology and some different catalysts, it allows us to transform those waxy molecules into something better. So it's actually changing those a little bit, getting rid of the wax, but still keeping the fuel itself. So it's a combination of more crude, more diesel, and how all that shakes out. We should make, I mean, with renewable diesel co-processing, we're expecting to make 2,000 to 3,000 barrels more a day, which okay. is a fairly big increase.
That is, so you're expanding the capacity. Has, I guess, out of the Illinois Basin, where the oil comes from, mm-hmm. the crude, that's the right word.
Yep.
Has that always been like the capacity of the refinery has kind of been the choke point? I mean, you can bring in more oil faster than you can refine. Is that correct?
Yeah. So, I mean, historically, the refinery ran 100% Illinois Basin crude. 15 years ago, we were at, 20,000 barrels a day. And, 20 to 25 is before my time. But as we've continued to invest in the refinery and expand to make us more competitive and to supply, growing member demand for fuels, we've expanded the refinery over time. And now we have to purchase crude outside of the Illinois Basin also. Mm. So we've been doing that since about 2016. Just incrementally more external crude. So we buy crude from, Oklahoma, from North Dakota, so Bakken crude. So all those crude, mixes come into Patoka, Illinois. There's a big crude hub in Patoka, Illinois, and we connect to that and bring external crude. So we're not limited today by crude availability. It's more of just lining up, a refinery is kind of like, a bunch of little pots. And if you fill up one pot, you have to make sure that the next pot down the stream has enough room, and so you're constantly increasing capacity of one thing, and then you have to leapfrog and increase capacity of another thing. So we've done that successfully, during my time here, where we just consistently added more capability, and then you have to go through the same process of do my pipelines to get the crude into the refinery, and then my pipelines in River Dock to get the products out. Do I have enough capacity there? So this is standard in the industry. You're kind of always adding the next capacity, to remove any bottlenecks.
That's fascinating.
So we hear a little bit about this 45Z tax credit and for renewable fuels, and we hear a lot about sustainable aviation fuel. So I don't know that I'm smart enough to even formulate necessarily questions on mm-hmm. those things, but tell us a little bit about the 45Z tax credit. When we hear about that and sustainable aviation fuel, because right now the products, the ethanol and the biofuels that are produced in the United States aren't necessarily being used for sustainable aviation fuel. So today that adaption is not helping our farmers necessarily, correct? And maybe carbon intensity scores, if you yes. want to talk about oh, yeah. that as well. So
no, yeah, this is the whole thing. So this is a classic example, I guess, of the unintended impacts of government policy. So government made, obviously we had, renewable fuel standard, which was, this is a long time ago, but it was really energy independence was the focus of increasing local, our energy supply produced here. So we said, hey, let's take corn and soybeans and we'll produce renewables and we'll blend it into our transportation fuel. That's kind of like the, the genesis of all this. The challenges with that were that we had a RIN program, so RIN was kind of meant to be a subsidy to help you blend ethanol, and it's as we've increased mandates over time, it's turned into a monstrosity of a program, and one of the key portions of that program was the blender tax credit. So $1 a gallon would go to a biodiesel producer for putting biodiesel into diesel, and what would happen is that those biodiesel producers struggled economically without that dollar. So they really need that dollar tax credit to be profitable. Because think about it. You're buying, soybean oil, which might be $5 or $6 a gallon, and you're selling it as diesel, which is, $2, $3, maybe $4 a gallon in big times. So you're losing money on every gallon you sell. The only way that you can recoup that is through the RIN. And so that's basically how this industry has evolved, is that I'm buying biodiesel, really soybean oil way over the cost of diesel. I'm selling it as diesel and losing money, but then I get a RIN that offsets my cost.
We may stop right there. Just say RIN. It's not W-R-E-N, not like the bird. It is R-I-N, which means?
Yeah, it's a renewable identification number. So every gallon of renewable fuel, whether it's ethanol or biodiesel, is assigned a unique, I think it's a 36-digit, you know, it's government, 36-digit
no
number.
Way.
Yep.
He's got them all memorized.
Every gallon?
Yeah, every gallon. And it's that number 36? Stays with the fuel. Yep. Oh yeah, and they all has a meaning and a structure behind what all the what all the numbers are. So those are the credits. So if Country Mark blends a gallon of ethanol into our fuel, the ethanol producer says, "Hey, you blended this gallon. We're gonna sell this ethanol to you," and they send you kind of a record of that gallon and that identification number. And then we do that, millions and millions of times, and then retire those RINs to the EPA as part of our compliance. So that RIN has a value. Right now, they're about 56 cents for ethanol RINs. They've been as high as $1.80 or so. So prices have come down pretty substantially. And so those are the RIN is kind of a balancer of the market. So in the biodiesel example, I'm buying soybean oil, for $4, $5, $6 a gallon. I'm selling it as diesel and losing money. You say that doesn't work, but I get a RIN, which has some value, and hopefully those three things line out. The biodiesel producers struggle to make money in that scenario, but they have $1 a gallon blender tax credit. So, if net of the soybean oil price, the diesel price, and the RIN, I'm still underwater, I still get $1 back in tax credits that will help make me profitable. And so biodiesel producer margins kind of float around, trying to recoup that dollar. That program ends in 2024, and it's replaced with basically a clean fuel production credit. And that's the 45Z, and there's a lot of these 45 rules that spawn from the IRA. And basically what that does is it says, hey, you can get $1. You can still get the dollar, but it's a carbon intensity-based benefit. And so you have to be below a 50 CI carbon intensity, and then it's a formula for how far below you are, below 50, of how much that dollar you get. And so this is kind of the question is, and what biodiesel producers and ethanol producers are going to try to do, they're going to try to lower the carbon intensity of their product to capture more of that credit. The challenge is that it's hard to get biodiesel and ethanol much below 50. You can do things, and that's kind of what's going to happen is it's going to be a carbon intensity divide that starts in 2025. To where if I'm an ethanol plant that's done certain things to lower the carbon intensity, I'm going to, I have a competitive advantage. Same with biodiesel. And so that's what's going to happen. Co-processing is not eligible for that tax credit. So we'll be excluded from that. And we'll see how the industry evolves. But the key change is that we're changing from a biodiesel blender tax credit, basically, to a carbon intensity-based system. So we'll see how this shakes out.
And that'll go all the way back to the farm. I mean, that's going to start. So some of the things the biodiesel processor can do is buy grains that have quantified their CI score.
That's right.
There's a lot. I mean, there's a lot to this whole thing.
Oh, no, for
sure.
It
seems like real money, real opportunity. But
yes.
And some of these things, farmers don't need to change a lot about what they're doing. They just need to document what they're doing, and then that gets passed along, and ultimately somebody's going to benefit from that, and it's going to be somebody out there that's going to be buying this stuff that wants this product. The demand will be there ultimately.
So. No, for sure. I mean the RFS mandates will Country Mark believes though the EPA will continue to increase the mandated amount of blending. And that will keep demand high for soybeans and corn for ethanol. But what will start happening is there will be some type of benefit to lowering your CI where maybe the elevator says, hey, I'll pay you more for this, or I won't discount you potentially for this.
Sure.
And we don't know which way that will go. But the long story of it, or the short story is demand should be there. and there are benefits to farmers from lowering their carbon intensity. And part of our vision is, you know, this is a small step, but if CountryMark can, lower the CI of our fuel that farmers use in their fields through this project, can they document that and track that, and does that provide some benefit to them down the line with who they're selling their product to? That's part of the goal, is to have a more circular economy where our farmers and our members that use our products get some benefit, and it's more of a circular economy.
Yeah, very good.
That's fascinating.
Yep, for sure. So energy transition, where are we at with energy transition? We know we've been hearing about it for a long time, and
yeah,
internal combustion engines and all of that. So what's your what's the Matt Makinson take on this?
Yeah, so a couple things. I think that I think about this a lot. And basically, after 2020, we had kind of a huge surge in net zero, in sustainability, in lowering carbon. And this has been the direction that we've really been pushing from the government, from corporations and boardrooms, the SEC, ESG scores that people talk about of, hey, I'm trying to lower my environmental, impact. And we saw this huge swell. And recently, what's happened is that, and this is kind of my theory, is that a lot of the energy transition, the foundation of it was built on sand. It wasn't a firm foundation. And one of the main problems is that it's energy density problem. And so, as we've used energy, across civilization, and we burn wood, obviously for fuel and heat and things, and then we move to coal. Coal has more energy density than wood. And then we've transitioned over the past, 50 plus, 100 years to oil and natural gas, significantly more energy dense, nuclear, very, very energy dense. And so as we've evolved, we've replaced forms of energy with better, more efficient, more energy dense forms of energy. A lot of the energy transition is the other way. It's intermittent, so wind and solar. And it's just less energy dense. There's less, EV batteries. It takes a lot of battery to create a same amount of energy as in, a pound of oil. It takes 1,000 pound of, advanced batteries to have the same amount of energy. So it's less energy density. And that's a challenge with the energy transition, the way we're doing it today. Unless some new technology comes that changes that, that's a challenge. So there's just physics problems. And one of the things that we're seeing is that the realities of physics are starting just to be seen. So Ford, the number that I read was that they lost $65,000 for every EV that they produced. People can do that for a while, but you can't do that forever. And now they've, I just read today that they sent a note out to dealers to say, hey, pause EV investments for a little bit. We got to do some thinking here. We got to do some research on what's going on. And on the EV side, you've seen a lot of people that had big announcements, big investments, preparing the way for EVs. They're starting to say, man, this is a challenge, whether it's consumer demand, it's just physics. There's challenges with that. It's hard to make money selling these things. And EVs, truthfully, are the ones that people are buying mostly. It's in the coast counties, and very people who are more likely to vote Democrat in the coast are the big buyers of EVs. So that's a philosophy thing. Hey, I'm doing this because I think it's a good thing to do, or it's a status symbol of it's a luxury vehicle. So I can afford a luxury vehicle, and I want the benefits of the battery technology. But this is not going across the countryside, and we're seeing lower demand, challenging to make money, and we'll see how this shakes out. On the other side, the government's kind of going the other way and doing different programs that mandate EV sales. So I see this energy transition, consumer choice is not there, and then this kind of foundation of sand, of physics are kind of coming home to roost a little bit. It's challenging to make this work, whether it's wind, whether it's solar, whether it's EV batteries. As challenges. I don't think that the trajectory long-term is changing. We've kind of decided that we're going to lower carbon and, potentially lower carbon in the atmosphere, and we've got a bunch of different ways to do that. That's not changing, but it's just kind of, I think it's a slowing down of the progression, and we'll see which way it goes.
I've never thought about it. I've never had it explained to me that way, about a pound of coal or a pound of wood or compared to a pound of battery. Is that the right way to think about it?
Yeah.
And that is just a neat way to think about, like, the in an energy density of what you're using.
Yes.
It doesn't make any sense from that perspective.
It's a lot of challenges. And then you have some other problems with energy transition of China owning a lot of the supply chain, whether it's solar, whether it's battery technology, or the metals that are required, rare earths. Yep. They own a huge percentage of the supply chain, and they're the ones that are producing it and benefiting. And so if you go back to the RFS and you say, hey, that was part of an energy independence concept of, hey, let's blend, you know, stuff that we produce here into our fuels to make us more energy independent. We've been doing this now for 15 plus years. And then now the government's kind of moving back towards, hey, let's try to push EVs, which remove a lot of independence from United States. So there's challenges there also.
A little bit of mission creep.
Yes.
I like to go back to what was the original intent of what we were trying to do, and now we're going to be more reliable on overseas metals and things for batteries.
Yes. Yeah. So that's a challenge.
Well, it looks like there's a spot, but these mandates are making this tricky because there'd be a place for them. We've heard some specific spots that, hey, this looks pretty good. Some certain pieces of heavy duty equipment that might be battery operated due to where they're operating, inside a building, next to a building, in the more inner city area or whatever. Those things make some perfect sense, but you can't feel like that's the narrative or that's what we're driving up these mandates saying. We're just eliminating all internal combustion engines and this is the way we're going. And going, none of this makes sense. I mean, the feel good starts to hurt after a while.
No, for sure.
It only feels so good for a minute and then we're over it. So
yeah, I mean, battery technology obviously will continue to improve. It has improved significantly. I mean, you see this from power tools to, blowers and things that they've gotten better over time. But to try to understand how complicated and large the U.S. auto industry is and how many cars, we've got 278 million cars. Majority of those are internal combustion engines. So ICE is kind of the acronym that people use, internal combustion engine. That's just your typical, gas or diesel engine. So California, passed a law basically restricting sales until eventually outlawing sales of internal combustion engines by 2035. And that's been, that's going through the courts and all these things, but this is kind of their path, is that we're not going to allow you to purchase a internal combustion engine in California in, 11 years. And it's kind of a phase out of that over time. The EPA has done similar things. So they continue to increase CAFE standards. So it's mile per gallon for the fleet. So there's, longstanding rules on mile per gallon requirements for U.S. automakers. And those are increasing over time. And they've, just passed new ones that will basically force a higher percentage of U.S. produced vehicles to be EVs, because you can't meet the mile per gallon rules without having a higher percentage of EVs in your car fleet. And they just recently passed what people call these tailpipe rules, and basically it's we call it like a de facto or kind of like a backdoor EV mandate, because you cannot meet the requirements without increasing your EV production. And if you go through the math, it's basically like a 70% of vehicles sold will have to be EVs by 2032 to meet these requirements. It's kind of interesting. None of the vehicles that are produced today can meet the requirement today. And, some of the math that I've read from AFPM, who's our, refinery trade group, is that you have to sell 4 EVs for every truck that you sell to meet the requirements. And so you say, okay, well, if this, it's being challenged in court, but this, it's in the register today, and you say, okay, if this really did start to go this way, where it's a progression of less and less internal combustion engines allowed, how are the auto manufacturers going to react to this? How are they going to do this? You either have to substantially increase the price of internal combustion engines, or you have to significantly lower the price of EVs, which they're not making money at selling today. And so you say, this is not going to work. The government is forcing buyers to purchase an EV that they don't want, and they're forcing auto manufacturers to make EVs and sell them, and basically, outlawing internal combustion engines, which is pretty incredible.
Is the world doing this, or is this just the United States? I mean, I can't imagine that some country, mm-hmm. that countries that are emerging economies are going through all this.
Well, yeah. So it's a combination of a couple different things. So like in parts of Europe, you know, their you know, public transportation, the way people use automobiles is different than the United States for sure. And a lot of those countries have, you know, significant, you know, incentives to purchase EVs. And so like in Norway and Finland and in Germany, you are seeing, you know, consistently high, you know, EV sales or hybrids or different things. And those are increasing. But Europe has a bunch of different complicated programs that penalize you for carbon, whether it's a refinery, very, very messy, you know, penalties for higher carbon. The rest of the world, China and India, no.
Yeah.
And then the U.S., obviously, you know, big automaker hub. What does this do to that industry? It can't be good. You're forcing automakers to make products that they struggle to make money at by mandate. So, you know, it's not consumer choice. It's not capitalistic. It's government mandate, which is challenging.
I was going to comment. I read saw a news article. Toyota didn't go down the EV route. They picked the hybrid route, and that mm-hmm. seems like, from a layman here, that seems like the better path. I mean, it seems like the gas or the internal combustion battery mix somehow is a better combination instead of all or nothing. But
yeah, I mean, it seems like consumers like that option, you know. And obviously, yeah, you're right. I mean, Toyota's gone down that road. They've got a bunch of different hybrid models where you get, you know, some of the benefits of both. Where you get, you know, better gas mileage. You can, you know, some of them, you know, will charge your battery while you're coasting and things like that, which are interesting technologies. The challenge is that a lot of the benefits are not available to Toyota for that. So, like, there's a zero emission vehicle credit in California where you get credits for zero emissions. So it's Teslas, basically. Mm. So those credits are available to a company like Tesla, and they make hundreds of millions of dollars selling those credits to other automakers in California.
Gosh.
Oh, yeah. So things like that, not eligible from a Toyota standpoint. So they've kind of gone that way, and consumers seem to have followed them to that, but they're missing out on some of the benefits. You know, it's not the chosen path for the government. The government's pushing, you know, more battery only.
We have to give some credit to the auto manufacturers. I mean, I think back to, I've got a pickup truck at home that my dad bought new when I was in high school in 1990. It's probably a 185 horse pickup truck, gets 16 miles a gallon. And the one I drive every day to work is a 400 horsepower truck that gets 23-24 miles a gallon. So clearly there's been a lot of technology and performance. They've built performance into these things, but they've also built efficiency into these things because these CAFE standards have been around for a while. So I would like to try to tie this conversation up, or we can go for the next 2 hours. I don't care either one, because it's very interesting. But we just started this podcast with increasing the production of the refinery, producing more diesel fuel, producing more crude, or processing more crude. The market says we're doing away with crude oil, crude-based fuels, and fossil fuels. What's your theory? What is your theory from basically, it looks like, to our listeners, maybe we're trying to do two things. Mm-hmm. We're wanting to produce more of this, but yet everybody's saying you got to get rid of them. Where are you on that? How do you answer that for somebody who would ask?
Yeah. So 80% of the world's energy comes from fossil fuels. So coal, oil, natural gas. And we don't see that changing anytime in the next 20 years. Our current belief is that the energy transition that we're going through is not really a transition, but it's going to be additive. So if you look at global population, moving towards 9 billion people on the planet, not necessarily in the United States, but global energy demand, you know, as Africa increases standard of living, uses more energy. So energy demand long-term is still increasing, and fossil fuel demand should be very, very strong. A lot of the new demand will be met with, you know, new sources of energy, whether it's wind, whether it's solar, electrification. renewable, you know, diesel or, you know, ethanol, that new demand will be met with those things, not necessarily pirating, you know, traditional gasoline and diesel. And we look at, you know, a lot of our diesel is sold, you know, to school systems, construction companies, you know, home-based fleets, and then farmers, obviously. And the path to electrify those industries seems a long way away, you know, long before this project hopefully will pay off. So long-term, I'm not worried about that. But you're right. There is a push from the government and from the EPA and from all the powers that be to, you know, against our industry to try to, you know, try to, you know, reduce fossil fuel use, basically. But we're combating that with, you know, a lot of this new production will be met with renewable sources and, you know, has all those benefits.
Sure. So it's, I mean, you're clearly trying to do the best you can do. A lot of these refineries always have done the best they can do. And that's the problem with the mandate. You don't get credit for doing, for blending every gallon you can and stop there. It's a, you just need to blend every gallon you can. They say, no, you've got to blend this many. Well, I can't. Well, then you're going to pay us.
Yeah.
And that's where a lot of that comes from. And that's tricky. But yeah, it's good for you guys thinking about this all the time, because I know it's still very important to all of us as we produce crops and transport items that that we have a reliable fuel source to keep things moving. So
no, for sure. Yeah, I mean, diesel powers the world, and you know, we're excited about it. And obviously, you know, we're buying soybean oil from, you know, local facilities that will buy soybeans from, you know, from our trade area. And so, you know, supporting all, you know, farmer demand, continuing to blend ethanol in all of our gasoline, and trying to make good decisions about an unknown future of, you know, what the energy transition means for us.
Sounds good. Indiana refinery owned by farmers, supporting farmers. So
that sounds really
like
good.
It. Yeah, yeah, it does. It really does. So you got anything else for Matt?
I do not.
Matt, let's not wait two more years for you to come back and see us. We thank you for your time. Do you have anything else you want to add before we close down?
No, appreciate you having me.
All right. Sounds good. Well, that's another episode of the High Ground, powered by Premier Companies. Please like and subscribe. Thanks.